Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
The path to reconciliation is one of listening, learning, and growing together. A path that recognises the central place of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people in our past and in our future. It is in that spirit that we acknowledge the traditional owners of the land and pay tribute to elders past, present, and future.
Welcome to Policy Forum Pod, the podcast for those who want to dig a little deeper into the policy issues facing Australia and the world. Policy Forum Pod is produced by the Crawford School of Public Policy at the Australian National University. I'm Anna Greta Hunter. I'm a cardiologist and physician. I'm the Human Futures Fellow at NSEF. And I am here today with my adorable co-host, Sharon Bessel.
Anna Greta, I have to tell the listeners that I slipped the word adorable in as the description, and I was wondering whether you would use it or not.
Yeah, but you took it out of the script, Sharon. I was always going to say that.
Thank you to my adorable co-host. I'm Sharon Bessel. I'm a professor of public policy here at the Crawford School. And we are in the midst of some incredible conversations about the big ideas that shape and change and hopefully improve our world. In terms of impact on our daily lives, there are few things that are more significant than infrastructure. So just imagine for a moment all of the infrastructure that's in our communities, across our nation, across the globe, from the roads and the bridges that we drive on daily, to the structures that we live, work, shop, and play in, to the schools and hospitals that we rely on. Infrastructure is all around us, and it really does structure our lives. It's also big business, with almost $300 billion committed to infrastructure projects in Australia alone. When we invest such large amounts of money, we need to be sure that we're investing well. In their design, development, and construction, there's often pressure for major infrastructure projects to move ahead quickly. But there are often delays, and some of those delays are a result of a lack of community consultation and inadequate consideration of the social dimensions of infrastructure. So how do we ensure that the human, the social, and the environmental aspects of infrastructure are deeply considered as the engineering and the business planning takes place? And how is social risk mitigated? And how do we ensure that infrastructure serves people and communities? Anna Greta, I think this is going to be a great conversation about what infrastructure means in our lives. Would you like to introduce our fabulous guest? Perhaps I should say our adorable guest.
Adorable, definitely adorable. Sharon, this is such an important conversation, and I love the fact that it weaves together the things that we are often talking about here on Policy Forum Pod. We are delighted to be joined by Professor Sarah Bice, who is the Director of the Institute for Infrastructure in Society at the Crawford School of Public Policy, an institute that she co-founded alongside Kirsty O'Connell several years ago. Sarah, welcome.
Anna Greta, Sharon, thanks so much. It is adorable to be here.
What a great way to start. Sarah, I wonder if we could start by asking you to tell us a little bit about the Institute for Infrastructure in Society and what inspired you to co-found it.
Thanks, Anna Greta. Well, what inspired me was probably almost two decades of working as a social scientist in hard engineering environments. So I started my career working with communities affected by major mining and extractives projects across the globe, really seeing the ways in which this huge infrastructure and machinery was affecting people in their local lives and the ways in which that lived experience, the ways in which their daily lives were changed by these massive industries, was not really well acknowledged or understood or incorporated into private sector or government decision making. There was so much focus on the economic advantage, on the structural physical infrastructure need, that it really felt as though communities were being left out, rather ironically, from the things that affect the quality of their lives and their access to things like services, transport, parks and gardens, hospitals, schools. So over years of working around these projects from a very different perspective to the engineers and project managers and financers, I was very concerned to think about how can we better acknowledge the social components of these big technical projects? How can we better integrate the lived experiences, the daily lives of community members? And how can we ensure that when we are making what are usually very substantial investments, we're talking, if not hundreds of millions, often billions of dollars of investment, how can we ensure that we're getting not only benefit for the communities who are here today, but also for the future generations? So this was something that really spurred me on. Around about 2015, my very dear colleague, Kirsty O'Connell, came to me from industry. She had been working as a communications and community engagement manager on more than $20 billion of Australian infrastructure projects. So she knew her game. And she came to me and she said, "Oh, I really think you could help us. We really need to understand social license. We really need to better integrate the social aspects of these big projects into the work that we do." And perhaps it's a bit of a funny story, and it tells you, I think, a lot about the life of academics who sometimes beaver away in our offices writing things and wondering if anyone ever pays any attention. Kirsty originally contacted me via email, and the email said, "You know, dear Professor Bice, I have read your work and I think it's really important and I think industry should know about it and I want to come and talk to you." And I thought it was spam. So it took quite a while for Kirsty and I to get together because I couldn't believe that someone from industry had actually read an academic journal article and gotten in touch. And one day she literally showed up at my office door and said, "Hey, I'm here in town. You know, I've written to you a few times. I haven't heard back." And thank goodness she was so persistent, because now 7 years down the track, we have established the Institute for Infrastructure in Society. And together with now about 17 industry and government partners, we are pursuing a social and policy science research agenda that we have co-designed with industry to really start to acknowledge social components of infrastructure delivery, to raise the profile, and to provide the sector with evidence-based tools that they can use to better manage these unwieldy and sometimes amorphous social components.
Sarah, that's a great story of how the Institute started off. Thank goodness for persistence, and thank goodness for being able to go and knock on someone's door when email and all else fails us.
Yeah, good for her being persistent. She's very tenacious.
Absolutely. Sarah, you talked a little there about co-design, and that's central to the work that the Institute does. I think about co-design and I think about the work that I do around social policy, and co-design is very much around inclusion, ensuring a diversity of views and priorities and experiences are heard. And in that work, co-design can be a very powerful tool for fostering social inclusion. I wonder if you can just share with us a little more about the way you think about co-design in relation to major infrastructure projects. And does it become a tool for social inclusion in a meaningful way, or can it be perhaps a more pragmatic strategy of just minimizing social opposition?
Yeah, Sharon, this is a terrific question. And I think just to answer that last question so that we don't forget about it, it's definitely both. So co-design can both be a genuine way of incorporating community views and priorities into infrastructure selection, design, and delivery. It can also be a means of kind of pushing back or hopefully circumventing opposition. And we can get into a conversation later about the complexities around that, because that can work both in favor and against local communities. So it's an area of tension. My own work in co-design owes an enormous debt to Dr. Kirsty Jones. So I seem only to work with Kirsty's, but if anyone else wants to come and work with me and you have a different name, I will consider the option. Dr. Kirsty Jones is the Institute's research engagement and impact lead. Kirsty started her career in the UK with the Wellcome Trust. She is a biochemist. She works in public health, and in the commitment to lateral thinking, we thought she would be a great member of our infrastructure team, because what she brings to the table is this deep knowledge and experience of how to create co-design in a genuine way. Some of her past work, as an example, has looked at how do you create food labeling, which allows consumers to really understand complex nutritional information so that they can make health-based decisions. And her work was integral to policy change in the UK. Now, that might seem really far removed from infrastructure, but there are some really strong connections. Many infrastructure projects are very technical. They involve engineering plans. They involve years and years of project management. And apart from the construction phase, when your route to school is disrupted by traffic detours and congestion, we don't tend to pay a lot of attention. So Kirsty is very good at thinking about how do we shape the questions that we ask community participants so that those questions are meaningful to them. Co-design for us involves bringing together all of the different stakeholders who are affected by and can affect a particular issue. So when we look, for example, at renewable energy infrastructure, we want to make sure that as we're taking decisions around that, we're bringing in the communities who are going to be host to major infrastructure. And in Australia, we have a big challenge in renewables because often the communities who are going to host the energy infrastructure, which really changes the aesthetics of a local area and also land access, those communities tend to be really distant from the people who are going to benefit from the electricity generated. So we've got disparate community members who need to be included. We've got the Australian government, which is busy establishing things like the Net Zero Authority. And we also have really technical organizations like AEMO, the Australian Energy Market Operator. And then we've got the private sector, because most of the renewable energy infrastructure in Australia is being delivered by the private sector. So why do I mention all of these groups? Because with co-design, we have to start with that concourse of stakeholders, and we really have to make sure that we bring them all together. And one of the things that we spend a lot of time doing is bringing them together to define the problem. What we often find in traditional research is that the researcher will go out and will say to communities or the industry or government, hey, here's a problem that we can see that you have, and now we're going to go away and do this research and solve that problem for you. What we do in co-design, and this is a really important first step, and it relates to social inclusion because it's about empowerment. So the very, very first step that we take in co-design is bringing those stakeholders together, and without being presumptuous that we know what their issue is and that we know what they need, we take them through a facilitated process to agree what the problem is. Because in public policy, we know that the very, very best policymaking occurs when we have a shared agreement about the problem, and we can then focus our attention on solving that agreed problem. So co-design has to start with problem definition. And as researchers, it really pushes us to do what we call research as unusual.
Unusual. Sarah, you've talked about the ways in which the cumulative impact of infrastructure projects, the ways in which dust, noise, changes to the amount of green space, changes to community identity, disruptions and changes to how we go about our lives, the sorts of things that many of us will have experienced in our day-to-day environment. these changes can be exhausting and they can be disruptive in negative ways. And I'm quite interested, have been for a long time, in the relationship between our human health and the environment and the way in which these projects can both improve health and well-being and really detract from health and well-being. I would love to hear you talk a little bit about the cumulative impacts, how we can minimise it. How do we approach these issues and connect them?
Yeah, Anna-Greta, this is a really important question. So let's just paint a picture of what is happening in Australia right now in terms of the cumulative effects, and that means multiple projects happening at once in our domestic context. Right now in Australia, we are in an historically intensive infrastructure build. It well and truly is Australia's big build. We have a $300 billion infrastructure pipeline, the largest ever. Right now, almost three quarters, 71% of Australia's urban population is directly touched by major infrastructure delivery. So this is going to be a conversation that is relatable to many of our listeners. Australia has a number of mega projects underway. So these are projects which are $1 billion or more. 91% of mega projects, according to Infrastructure Australia, have at least one other mega project within 200 kilometers. 39% of those have at least one other mega project within 5 kilometers. There is a lot going on in terms of cumulative effects. So at I2S, we've been very interested to understand, how does this intensive environment affect community members? And how does it affect our capacity, given that the majority of infrastructure delivered in Australia is publicly government funded? How does it affect our capacity, our taxpayer dollars, to actually implement these projects? And what we have found is that doing surveys of almost 7,000 Australian community members, where community members are experiencing four or more projects at once, the indicators of community well-being in terms of them granting a social license to these projects and feeling that these projects are improving their communities, the indicators for community well-being go down in all of these communities where we have four or more projects operating at once. So what does that mean? It means that communities who are experiencing the most intensive infrastructure environments are less likely to agree that the processes of putting those projects in place are transparent to them. They are less likely to agree that the regulations in place to guide those infrastructure projects are effective. They are less likely to agree that they have positive relationships with the governments and project developers instituting those projects. And particularly where communities have six or more projects around them at one time, and we've measured this according to LGA, Local Government Authority, where communities have six or more projects happening at a time, they are far less likely than other community members to agree that there is a good overall planning picture for their community. So they're saying, look, we know there's a lot going on, but we're not really sure what's going on or why. Why is this important then for community well-being? Further research that we've done, and all credit to Mr. Sabit Otour, who is one of our research fellows and PhD candidates in the Institute. Further research that we have done demonstrates that there is a statistically significant relationship between communities' experiences of infrastructure delivery, whether or not they perceive it as risky, and whether or not they perceive it as providing improved livability benefits to their local area. Those factors directly inform levels of resilience in communities. And we know with the increase in climate events, severe weather, cost of living pressures, all of these things are affecting the capacity of Australian communities to bounce back from shocks and change. And infrastructure delivery does play a statistically significant role in the levels of resilience that our communities can achieve. The other thing that we see in relation to cumulative effects is that the number of infrastructure projects in a local area increases local residents' perceptions of risk. Now, this doesn't mean that bad things are happening, that risk is being realized, but local residents are saying, oh my goodness, there are a lot of projects going on around me at the moment. I don't really understand what the big picture is here. I'm really concerned about how this is going to affect my community. And those perceived risks also have a direct impact on the levels of local acceptance of the infrastructure build. And this becomes important not only because it disempowers community members, it makes them feel that they might be losing control of the shape and style of their local community, but we also know from other research that we've done that stakeholder and community pressure is one of the top three consistently most impactful factors on project delays. And where we experience delays, we experience increased costs. So cumulative effects are really challenging to deal with, but we also know that they affect levels of resilience in communities. They affect community members' faith in the government's capacity to deliver a good overall planning picture for them. They affect levels of acceptance of projects in local communities. And by extension, that is very likely to increase project delays and the costs of the projects in which our governments are investing.
Sarah, it's such a fascinating picture that you're describing for us, but it's also a very, very complex one. And listening to you talk, it strikes me just how many actors are involved in the process of infrastructure development and then I guess maintenance and so on into the future, but also the very deep interests that are at stake, from the interests of big corporations to government to community members. And that picture that you painted of the big build that's going on in Australia and the nature of those mega projects really demonstrates the ways in which people's lives are impacted very directly. Sarah, I'd love to hear your thoughts on how we balance or negotiate or perhaps navigate the power and the interests of all those actors, of developers, of corporations, of governments, of oppositions, and of communities in all their diversity. And where does technical and other expertise fit into all of that?
Oh, this is such a good question. So what's really interesting is that year on year, since 2017, we have run the State of Infrastructure and Engagement Survey. And this is a survey of infrastructure professionals in Australia. And those professionals are experts in their fields. And we ask them, how are your projects tracking? How are things going? And we also ask them, what are the most influential factors to delays that you've experienced or cancellations that you've experienced over the past year? And in our data since 2017 until today, and we're just about to launch the sixth annual State of Infrastructure and Engagement results coming up next month, those results show year on year, across all years, in less than 10% of cases, do infrastructure sector professionals rate technical issues as most impactful to delays. And in only about 11% of cases across all years of data, do they rate access to engineering skills as one of the major factors for delay. So within Australia, what we can say very confidently is we have the technical piece right. We have the skills in place. We've got the engineers. We have the capacity to deliver very complex projects. But what we see year on year is that the top three most impactful factors to project delays and cancellations are the trifecta of stakeholder and community pressure, regulatory and policy issues, and this consistently links to project politicization. So where a project is a campaign or a ministerial announceable, and there hasn't been necessarily a lot of community consultation about it. And the third factor is project funding, and that often relates to those political announceables. So we know that the social and policy components of projects are where we in Australia really need to focus our attention. Let's take that a step further then to think about your question, Sharon, of social inclusion. It is very common for us to think about infrastructure projects as being large pieces of technical engineering. We don't really think of them as social things. But let's think about gender for a moment. Infrastructure project design, maybe in public transport, that's a really good example. And we can think about the light rail in Sydney, or we can think about the Metro Tunnel, which is happening here in Melbourne, where I am today. Infrastructure project design is gendered. And by that, I mean the ways in which we design our infrastructure can have a very distinct consequence for women. The UN, the World Bank, and other international groups have focused a lot on this. And what we see is that where infrastructure is seen as gender neutral, or it's not designed with women in mind, we lose opportunities to make that infrastructure more accessible, to make that infrastructure safer, and to ensure that that infrastructure is accessed by vulnerable groups. So for women, social inclusion through infrastructure might include things like ensuring that there are open spaces around public transport platforms, that there's very good lighting at those platforms, that we ensure a sense of safety and security to facilitate women to use them. When it comes to transport operation, it might mean that the timing of public transport services are better linked to women's schedules, which often involve the school drop-off and pickup, so that we don't only have peak services or multiple services at 9 a.m. and 5 p.m., but we have more services around 2:30 or 3 o'clock when women may be ducking out of work to pick up children and come back. And these might seem like really minor decisions, but they are systemic decisions that, if done well, can support more social inclusion, and they can give women greater access to economic opportunities and participation. So lots and lots of complex issues to think about, but one of the things that we encourage the people we work with to do is to simply start by acknowledging that these very technical projects that they're producing are not just technical, they are gendered, and there are human beings out there who are going to use them. And we need to think about how that use influences what our society looks like and who can participate.
Sarah, that's such a fantastic overview of why we need to think about not just the technical, but the non-technical issues. And I think we would all agree that we want roads and bridges that are going to be technically sound and do the job that we need them to do and keep us safe. But those other issues that you talked about, and you said, you know, they may seem to be minor issues, but of course they're not, because they're the issues that impact directly on our lives. And they're major things. You know, they're about how we go about what we need to do every day. And they impact on our well-being. We're going to take a short break, and we're going to come back and talk about these issues in some more detail, including some of those issues around well-being and how infrastructure really shapes our lives. Sarah, we're enjoying this conversation immensely. We'll be back in a moment, and listeners, please don't go away.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Around the world, democracies are in crisis. Leaders have become followers. Populists offer glib solutions to complex problems, and people search for answers. Block out the noise. Each week on Democracy Sausage, we go deeper to bring you insights from leading scholars, journalists, and commentators to help you make sense of the world. I'm Mark Kenny from the Australian National University. Join me at the Democracy Sausage Hot Plate every Monday and Thursday.
Listeners, welcome back. We're here with Sarah Bice when we're talking about infrastructure and its broader impact. Before the break, we talked about the social dimensions of infrastructure projects, and they are, of course, highly significant to our health and the ways in which we live. Sarah, your research and the work of the Institute for Infrastructure and Society aims to mitigate environmental and social risks and optimise the potential benefits. I wonder if we can focus for a moment on the environment and how we minimise negative impacts on the environment, optimising the potential benefits, and how important are things like renewable energy in achieving this?
Oh, Anagreta, this is such an important question because we work in the, you know, social space, but everything we do is socio-environmental. And I think that that's really critical to recognise that deep interconnection. When we ask community members in our Australian Perspectives on Infrastructure survey, what social risks related to major infrastructure projects most concern them, the most highly ranked social risk of concern is actually environmental degradation. So community members also deeply recognize and feel this interconnection between the social and the environmental, and those environmental concerns top their lists of risks that concern them when it comes to major infrastructure project delivery. Let's take the renewables sector in Australia as an example for a moment. Again, remember before the break, I mentioned that our data shows, and certainly we can all see this in our daily lives, Australia has the technical expertise necessary to deliver major infrastructure, and that includes renewables. Right now, we have the access and capability to deliver the renewables technology we need to largely meet the targets that have been set. Now, of course, new technologies are going to emerge and things will change and get better, but we have the capacity now to do these things technically. In order to achieve climate adaptation, and to this question of the environment, we know what we need to do, and we have the technical components that we require in order to enact that change. But where's the key piece that we're often skipping over? And where we're starting to see tensions emerge, it's in social acceptance of renewable infrastructure. So in New South Wales, very recently, there's been the establishment of RESs, renewable energy zones. There was a very short public consultation period around the establishment of these zones. And many community members who are in the zones would argue that the consultation period was far too short to be constructive or genuine. Community members who are most likely to host renewable energy infrastructure, which we must have in order to address the environmental challenges that we face, not only as a nation, but as a planet, those community members are now starting to push back against plans which they feel have been developed rapidly and without appropriate consultation. In particular, if we look at the very rich agricultural and mining area of the Upper Hunter Valley in New South Wales, those communities are now being faced with policies which would put in place large-scale overhead transmission lines for renewable energy that's being generated. Now, this isn't to say that renewable energy overhead transmission lines are a bad thing per se. So that's not my point. My point is that this infrastructure is being introduced to local communities as a fait accompli. It is a huge visual and land access amenity change to this local area. Many people living and working in the Hunter Valley have been there with their families for multiple generations. They have a deep and abiding sense of connection to their local communities and environment, and a deep sense of what their community is in terms of identity and how it should look, what it should feel like, and how it should be managed. And now all of a sudden, they're experiencing all of the severe weather implications of climate change. They're starting to see this push from governments and private sector renewable energy groups coming in and saying, we have to do this. We're going to put these things on what people see as their land, and rightly so. And so there is a real tension emerging between the environmental imperative to deliver renewable energy infrastructure and our need to properly consult and engage with local communities to ensure that we're all on the same page and that we can collectively pursue environmental benefit. So, Arne Grete, when you ask this question about the environment, it's absolutely critical. Our research on all types of infrastructure for years has shown that social and community factors are really where we face challenges in delivery in Australia. We've got the technical piece right. The same is true for renewables. And my concern right now is that if we do not attend in a more systematized, genuine, and consultative way to communities in the renewable energy transition, it is going to be the social factors that inhibit our capacity to deliver the renewables that we need to the time scale that's necessary to achieve climate adaptation.
Sarah, you're reminding me why the work of your institute is just so incredibly important, and it's teaching us how to think through problems differently. And in healthcare, we have a similar challenge of working not just on the biology of disease, but seeing the broader social context and that biopsychosocial model that now I think we increasingly recognize the role of the environment. And so I think we see this across a multitude of disciplines in universities and in government departments, how we think our way across the technical, the social, and the environmental. You've given us a really important example there, I think, of the Hunter Valley. And I just wonder whether you could share with us one of your favourite projects, somewhere where they have managed to successfully navigate the environmental and the social elements of an infrastructure project.
That's such a good question. Do you know, sometimes where we see really good navigation of this intersection between the environment, the social, and the major infrastructure investment is actually in some of the smaller projects. So one of our partners in the Institute is Melbourne Water. And many people who live in Melbourne will know Melbourne Water because we see their trucks around everywhere, and they're probably digging up the street frontage outside your house right now to make your sewage or your water pipelines better if you're living here in Melbourne. But a few years ago, Melbourne Water in Murrumbina, they needed to put in place some flood mitigation measures. And this project was a real success. It was a real example of working with local communities to deliver not only the environmental benefits of flood mitigation, but also to get community consultation and buy-in into what that flood mitigation looked like. So working with the local communities around Murrumbina, Melbourne Water identified that there was an opportunity where they were putting in flood mitigation measures to also improve and increase local access to active transport, things like bike lanes or, for some of us, e-scooters. And so what they did was they worked with the local community to not only put in place the flood mitigation infrastructure, but also to align that with some active transport. And even though it was disruptive for the construction period, at the end of the project, what communities received back was a much improved public space with more active transport opportunities, and a response to changing environment. And as a second example, and very quickly, we see really similar work being done at the moment through the South Australian Government Department for Infrastructure and Transport, where, like here in Victoria, they have a level crossing removal project underway in order to improve public road safety. Now, perhaps surprisingly, in both Victoria and Australia, level crossing removal has been really controversial. And that's because it does require major construction and local amenity change for the residents closest to the train lines. So it may mean, for instance, that your house, which was comfortably next to a ground level train line for all of the years in which you've owned it and enjoyed it, is now going to have an overhead sky rail nearby. And you're thinking to yourself, I don't want this. I don't want that train traveling past my house however many times a day, peering into my back garden. And so these changes to level crossings have, for that and many other reasons, been really controversial. In South Australia, working with local communities around level crossing, it became clear that one of the things that local communities would value was better acknowledgement of local Indigenous custodians of the local land, and also better access to parks and garden facilities. And so the South Australian government, on one project in particular, commissioned an Indigenous artist to develop artworks that would go onto the big pylons that hold up the overpass, and also to design native Australian-friendly parkland to go in the new space that's been freed up underneath. And so that's another really great example where the government, local communities, and the infrastructure project constructor worked very constructively together to determine not only what are communities' concerns, but also what are some of the fairly simple things that we could put in place that would better acknowledge how communities want this space to look, and that gives them something that can live on for some time that they feel is representative of their community in the form of new parklands and Indigenous art. So two really great examples there, both relatively small projects, and I'd love to see more of that type of thinking applied to our major projects.
Sarah, they're both such beautiful and powerful examples, and you know the importance people placed on recognition of Indigenous land and Indigenous heritage, I think is really significant. I must say too, when I was doing my PhD, I lived in Murrumbina, so love the fact that Murrumbina was one of the positive examples that you gave. But Sarah, we talk a lot on this podcast about the importance and the immense value of well-being of both people and the planet. And that to me has come through so clearly in all that you've said, from the cumulative impacts of multiple projects to the importance of place to people, to recognising and respecting what really matters to communities, and how all of those things that need to be taken into account in infrastructure shape our well-being. I wanted to get your thoughts on how all of this fits with some of those big emerging and transformative conversations that we're having around well-being and a well-being economy. Are you seeing those discussions as significant in helping us to rethink the way we build infrastructure? And are there emerging trends that you see that connect the infrastructure sector to those transformative conversations, or are they kind of happening in parallel?
This is a terrific question again, Sharon. What we are seeing is perhaps not yet an emerging trend, but certainly a nascent interest in connecting major infrastructure planning and investment with well-being. Just yesterday, we were talking with our partners at the South Australian government, and they're questioning how can they ensure that their work in infrastructure, which is important for all the technical reasons that we've discussed, how can that work connect to things like a well-being budget? How can that work connect to things like creating social value. And I appreciate that's a fairly amorphous term, but that means how can infrastructure projects deliver the things that communities value most in terms of livability? It might be more parks and gardens. It might be more access to public indigenous art. It might be quicker transport to schools. Whatever it is, we're starting to see more thought put into not just delivering a great piece of infrastructure, but ensuring that that infrastructure is meeting those social factors that are most valued by communities. And our research shows that that does have a direct contribution to levels of well-being. And I think that that's a fairly obvious thing, but it's really nice to see it come out in research evidence. If we as community members know that we are receiving the infrastructure and services that are going to make our lives more convenient, safer, and better, we're going to feel a bit better, right? So these things connect really directly. Governments primarily do infrastructure in Australia at the state levels. So what we also need to start to see now from a policy perspective is a joining up of what the Treasurer is currently attempting to do around introducing ideas of a well-being budget with state and territory policies and activities. So this is going to require a whole of government approach. And we at the Institute are working with our government partners to start to embed some of the components of our work into their policy requirements. So as an example, usually when big infrastructure projects funded by government go out to tender, the tenderer needs to respond to all of these technical components. Oh yes, of course we can build this bridge to last for, you know, 150 years. And of course we can make your public transport more efficient. What we are working with our government partners to do is to start to embed in policy requirements, things like the Institute's Infrastructure Engagement Excellence Standards. So we have developed the world first quality assurance standards for what good community engagement looks like for major infrastructure projects. And what we want is for governments to say to project tenderers, not only are we going to build a great bridge, but we're also going to follow these standards and do it in a way that is best for communities. Similarly, we're working with our government and industry partners right now, and we're very thankful to the ARC who's funding this work. We're working with them right now to embed social risk management frameworks into project contracting, design, and delivery. And so again, what we're really trying to do here at the Institute, and thank goodness that we have a national university that is committed to societal transformation through research, we are working every day to try and embed these social concerns into very technical projects so that we can achieve a well-being benefit.
Sarah, what an amazing conversation we've had so far. I know Sharon and I could talk with you for so much longer. We started today's conversation noting that many billions of dollars are invested annually in infrastructure around Australia. And so as we close this fascinating and I have to say inspirational discussion, we'd love to hear your parting messages on what can ensure that investment is worthwhile, that it goes far beyond not damaging people in place, the environment or communities, to being an investment that really brings genuine benefit, sustainability, and the goals of inclusion that you've articulated so beautifully. What are the key principles that we should all be aware of and really demand that are upheld?
So the first is that we must understand that the social components of technical projects are just as important as the engineering, the financial investment, and the environmental aspects. So that's number one, is acknowledging the social factors as being equally important to these other factors that we're already doing a great job of acknowledging and working with. The second principle is that we need to work with institutes like the one that I direct to make those social factors better understandable to a technical industry. So it's one thing to go out and say we should create social value, we should attend to social risk, But what we must do is systematize those social factors, make them graspable, and put them into frameworks and tools that technical organizations and governments can deal with. So acknowledge that the social issues matter, because they do. Work to get those social issues clear and translated into ways that can be used by a technical industry. And then as a society, and the well-being budget and these conversations that are beginning in Australia is a really important part of this, we need to start to generate a wider shared understanding of the social issues that are in play, their degree of influence on our daily lives, and then start to shift our perspective, I hope, away from one that's purely financial investment and traditional risk management focused, towards one that is much more integrated and future focused. How are we going to benefit intergenerational change? How are we going to ensure that we have a sustained and sustainable planet? And how ideally are we going to do this in a way that's inclusive of all members of our societies and that creates economic opportunities for everyone?
Sarah Bice, it has been such a pleasure having you join us on Policy Forum Pod today. Thank you so much for our conversation.
Thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Anna Greta, that was such an interesting conversation. And for me, so many issues came out of it that connect to the themes that we so regularly talk about here on the pod, and themes that I so often see coming through in my research around the importance of place, the importance of identity, the importance of relationships to people. And all of that came out so powerfully in what Sarah was saying. And as she was talking, I was reflecting on recent debates that have been taking place in Tasmania, which is, you know, as our listeners probably know, where I grew up, but where I'm doing research at the moment. And Tasmania will now have an AFL team, which is very exciting. This is something that matters to many people in Tasmania, has real social value and real value in terms of identity. But where there has been a real debate and very deep dissatisfaction is that the AFL, the Australian Football League, required as a condition of entry the building of a very expensive, very large stadium in the centre of Hobart for Tasmania to have a football team in the national competition. And there's been so much opposition to that. And this really speaks to exactly what Sarah was talking about. You know, while people place social value on something, that infrastructure piece has not connected with the social value. And I think to some of the points that our dear colleague Sharon Friel makes about the commercial determinants of health, and that building of the stadium is driven by commercial interests and consideration of profit more than the social value that Sarah is talking about. So I think one day for budding PhD students out there, this would make a fascinating case study of all of those issues that Sarah painted a picture of in that really interesting conversation.
Yeah, it's the extraordinary way in which she demonstrates the benefit of working across the different silos, from the technical side with the engineering potential through to the social license and the environmental impacts. And I think this is the challenge of our time, how we can move beyond the siloed thinking of leaving infrastructure just in engineering and moving it out into a much broader context of society and environment. There's so much to learn from the conversation today. I do hope our listeners have enjoyed it as much as you and I have. I'm sure they will have.
I think so too, Anna Greta. I think this is one that we're going to come back to again and again. And it would be good to have Sarah revisit us to talk about the ongoing work she's doing. This podcast is produced by the Australian National University's Crawford School of Public Policy. If you like this episode, don't forget to subscribe to keep up to date. We've got some really exciting episodes in the next few weeks and months. And if you're feeling generous, you can leave us a review. We love hearing from you, so please reach out to us on the Crawford School's LinkedIn page or via email at policyforumpod@anu.edu.au. Our thanks, as always, to Hannah Scott for production and to Darcy Brompton and Alex Jackson for background research. From me, Sharon Bessel, it's bye-bye for now.
And from me, Anna Greta Hunter, we'll see you next week.